Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. I am very honored today to be speaking with Mr. Robert Joseph, who's a senior scholar at the National Institute for Public Policy. He was the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security in the George W. Bush administration from 2005 to 2007. Obviously, very keyed into what is happening with Iran. And we're going to talk about Iran, what led up to this, what may come out of this, and where, you know, who the players are that may emerge to stabilize and hopefully liberate the Iranian people. And Mr. Joseph, again, thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, interesting days, right? I mean, this is, we have been dealing with Iran for 47 years, almost 47 years, ever since the kidnapping of American diplomats in November 1979. And look, I mean, I was a teenager at the time, but that was a formative moment for me in terms of my outlook on American foreign policy, as I think it was for many people in my generation. It was a shock. And we have been doing, I think, just about everything else other than what we're doing right now for 46 plus years since then. Was this the right moment to try to change things? What would the regime have ever changed through any other means?
Well, I think you're right. The regime has been at war with the United States since its inception, since 1979. It has murdered literally thousands of Americans, starting in 79 into the early 80s with Beirut and the bombing both of the embassy and of the barracks, and then much later in Iraq and Afghanistan, when the IEDs produced by Iran killed thousands of our forces. It was one of the major contributing factors to our losses over those years. I, from my experience, concluded long ago that murder and violence are in the DNA of this regime, and it's not going to stop. Also in the DNA of this regime is the quest for nuclear weapons.
Right.
And here we've had failed negotiations going back almost three decades. And it is very clear that the policies of the past, the appeasement policies, the belief that we can negotiate an agreement that would end this regime's quest for a nuclear weapon, that has been proved to be a fallacy. And the regime was at a point where they even apparently tried to coerce our negotiators by saying that they had enough 60% enriched uranium for 11 nuclear weapons.
Right.
So I think this notion of imminence, is answered in that way, because it's only a small step and a very rapid step that can be measured in days, not weeks, to go from the 60% to enriched uranium. So I think the president was right in taking the action that he took. And remember, you know, he set the military objectives very clearly: the end of their ballistic missile threat, the drone threat, the end of their support for terrorism. We have achieved those military objectives. Now we are in that stage that is the most critical stage of a conflict, and that is, how does it end?
Right. By the way, and I should mention this just so the people who are watching this interview and listening to this interview understand this. You are not just the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. You are also the Special Envoy for Nuclear Nonproliferation. So I think, Mr. Joseph, you know a couple things about the leap from 60% to fully weaponized, highly enriched uranium. And I want to make sure that people understand that we are really actually talking to an expert here and somebody who's been on this case since we first discovered, I think, I want to say it was 2003, I think, when the Iranian nuclear weapons program was first exposed. And of course, they were denying it. It may have been 2005. I'm trying to remember, but you were right.
Well, it was first exposed, the secret facilities at Isfahan and Natanz, in August of 2002 by the NCRI. And it was in 2003 that we had an NIE, a National Intelligence Estimate, that did confirm that the Iranians had begun this covert effort to build the facilities for the conversion of uranium and then to enrich uranium through centrifuges.
Right. And so, again, more than two decades of knowledge of this. We're going to come back to the National Council of Resistance of Iran, the NCRI, in a moment when we start talking about what comes next. But yes, the NCRI is actually, and their allies within Iran are actually the source of much of the intelligence that we have received about not just the nuclear weapons program, it's a big part of that, but also the intentions of the Iranian regime. And that's something to keep in mind when we come to what comes next. In this instance, though, just right now as we're doing this, you're seeing the military options, the war. I know President Trump yesterday was kind of joking around and saying, well, people don't like the word war, so we'll just call it a military operation. This is war. I don't think we need to mince words. And it's not an illegitimate war. This is a war that's been coming on for, again, close to 47 years. But the primary objective of this is to stop the process of weaponizing that uranium and the creation of nuclear weapons, which would have made this a much more difficult challenge had we waited for that to happen. Are we going to be able to prevent that in this militarily? I'll just put it this way. Just in your estimation, is it possible to prevent this militarily, given where the uranium's at, given where the facilities are at? Or is this really going to require a regime change to fully secure those materials and put an end to those programs?
Well, the question is not one of capability, because I think there's no question it would, when it comes to the capability of the men and women in uniform in harm's way serving the United States. They have done a tremendous job. They have achieved the objectives. I mean, they're continuing forward, but the fundamental military objectives have been achieved. The question is not capability as much as it is resolve. And when the president laid out his military objectives, when we first began the conflict, now some 4 weeks ago,
right,
he also raised the prospect of the need for regime change. Regime change, not with American boots on the ground. That's not the formula.
Right.
But regime change by the Iranian people, for the Iranian people. This is their country. This is their responsibility. Now, by going after the leadership, by going after the centers of power, whether it's IRGC or MOIS or the Basij and others, we have, I think, provided the best circumstances for the Iranian people to rise up. The Iranian people, as you know, have risen up in the past, including in this past January,
right,
when tens of thousands turned out in the street. Over 30,000 were reportedly murdered by the regime. But that was not the first time, and it's not going to be the last time. The vast majority of the Iranian people, the estimates are up to 80%, despise this regime. And for good reason. This regime has treated them with nothing but brutality. They have stolen the national riches. I mean, this is a corrupt regime. I mean, they're in mullah's dressing. They're siphoning off the riches, the natural resources of the Iranian people, and the Iranian people have had enough. And I think they will rise up. But the question is, can the regime hold on long enough?
Yes.
Before the president decides to move on, declares victory and decides to move on, and before the Iranian people rise up. Because if they can do that, they won. If we leave the job and we leave the regime in place or the remnants of the regime, I think we lose. And that's the future in which we will face an Iran with a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, Mr. Joseph, I think that that's exactly correct. And I think what's interesting is that the other Gulf states now are pretty much coming to that same conclusion. After being attacked by Iran with ballistic missiles and drones, which Iran was attempting to, it was a strategy from Iran to get the other neighboring states to pressure the U.S. and Israel into backing off. That backfired. It has actually almost brought Saudi Arabia into the war directly. The UAE is talking about that as well. The Saudis are really the power there. And it looks like they are insisting to us that, okay, you've opened this Pandora's box. We may not have been on board with doing that, but now that you've done that, you have to finish the job. Now, I think Trump's inclined to do that anyway, but of course, domestic political pressures will make this difficult. In a way, and I hesitate to use this analogy because it didn't turn out well, in a way that Congress and the political establishment did not do with Barack Obama in Libya. And the reason why I bring that up is because I know very well that you were part of the team that actually successfully denuclearized the Gaddafi regime in 2003. And on the basis of, you know, mutual cooperation between Gaddafi and the United States, which Barack Obama and the EU pretty much blew up, hoping to get a popular uprising, ending up with a failed state. And I think the regime toppling, let me put it to you this way. I don't think you could get a worse situation than what we had prior to the military operation. I think we were really out of options at that point in time. And this was the only way that we could go. But it really does require regime change at this point of some kind. And even some sort of power struggle inside Iran for a short period of time may not necessarily be the worst case scenario compared to what we had, as opposed to what was going on in Libya, where we had a fairly cooperative dictator, at least, at the time that we imposed regime change from above, which succeeded, by the way. And, you know, people say, well, you can't get regime change from above. Well, we kind of did 15 years ago in Libya, and just the outcome wasn't what we wanted.
Well, the Libyans, of course, agreed to denuclearize, to right. end their program, and not just end their program, to allow us to sail a large ship in and put everything associated with the nuclear program and, by the way, their longer range Scud missiles onto our ship to bring it back to the United States. So I think that was the cleanest sort of example of denuclearization or counter or non-proliferation that you can find.
Well, and that was right. And that was a kudo to you. You were the chief negotiator for that arrangement. So I bring this up because I know that you were very much sort of the key person in that, and it was successful.
Well, I was the negotiator, but let me tell you, it's first and foremost an intelligence success story. I mean, the intelligence community did an outstanding job in setting the table for the negotiations. And the negotiations, I mean, they were set well, not only by the intelligence community, but by the fact that we had sent 300,000 or more forces to the region to enforce Security Council resolutions about WMD in Iraq, if you remember.
Yep.
And Gaddafi really believed that he was going to be the next on the target list. And that made for a very compliant adversary on the other side, across the table. They were damned if they do and damned if they don't. And that's, as a negotiator, exactly where you want the other side to be. And I wish we could put the Iranians in that situation today. We may be moving in that direction, but again, it's patience and resolve. We have to have that resolve. And I think you're absolutely right about the Gulf states, because they realize that in a future in which even the remnants of this regime remain in power, they're going to be faced with a neighbor who, first of all, has a nuclear weapon, because have no doubt that is one of the lessons learned by the regime.
Yes.
If they had a nuclear weapon, they wouldn't be taking this beating. But the second lesson deals with their ability to disrupt international trade, to disrupt the world economy by cutting off the flow of oil. And that's a very powerful tool. That's the tool that they're using to put pressure, economic pressure and political pressure on the United States. I mean, if you think about it, President Trump has always been very pleased to talk about sort of the drop in oil prices and the price of gas at the pump. as well as the rise of the stock market. Well, now you've got the reverse. You've got the fall of the stock market and the rise of gas prices. And it's months before the midterm. And the Iranian regime understands the potency, the power of their ability to to produce results or to produce pressure by cutting off the flow of oil. And we can't, I think, in the future accept a situation in with either one of those are true, having a nuclear weapon or having the ability to disrupt our economy.
Yeah. Again, I think this is short-term thinking on the part of Iran, because they're basically demonstrating the need for the total destruction of the regime. Now,
well, we'll see if they get away with it.
I suspect not. I mean, after listening to today's briefing, I think that, and of course, what's being said by the other Gulf states, Israel certainly has a vote in this as well, because they might, you know, they may not want to just simply take the Iranian regime's word for it, as it were.
You think?
Yeah. I think that they, this is a one and done for them. They want to see this all the way through. The Gulf states now want to see this all the way through. And I think that's going to have a lot of impact on Donald Trump's thinking. The other thing I think too,
and I agree with you.
I think this is outside, of course, maybe it's a little bit more outside your portfolio, but I'll just mention it, is I think that Donald Trump is not really convinced that Republicans are going to do very well in the midterms anyway. And this is his last opportunity basically to change the world in the way that he sees fit. And that the long-term electoral consequences of a, you know, several week war may really not be weighing on his mind as much as the necessity of the outcome, which would be a good thing. It would be an unusual thing in politics, but it'd be a good thing.
Yeah. And just think of his legacy.
Exactly.
I mean, the legacy of having ended the Mullah's regime, 47 years of religious dictatorship. And not only a dictatorship, but a dictatorship that was at war with the great Satan.
Yep.
It would be a monumental achievement alongside of Venezuela. And let's hope Cuba is next.
Yep. Hopefully they just decide to go peacefully into that regime goes peacefully into the night. We don't necessarily need to do what we're doing to Iran, because they're not a threat to us in that way. Well, let's get back to what happens. Let's say the regime collapses. And right now it's kind of looking like we're seeing some of that. And the NCRI probably has some interesting, maybe you've got some insight that you can tell us from the NCRI's sources on this. But there was a some sort of statement today that the IRGC is now going to draft 12-year-olds or allow 12-year-olds to enlist. That's a sign that you're dealing with a rank and file collapse. There's huge, massive vacuums in leadership now at several different levels in the IRGC and the Basij. The US and Israel have been careful not to go after targets in the civilian government, and I believe the what you would call the regular army in Iran, which would be primarily, I would guess, infantry. And perhaps they're hoping that those are poles that will be willing to negotiate an end if once the IRGC collapses. What do you see as the end game here? How does a collapse start? What's already happening within Iran based on the intelligence that the NCRI is seeing on this?
Well, first of all, I would say that my reading of history, perhaps like yours, is that revolutions are very messy things.
Yep.
And they don't unfold in a single direction or a predictable manner. What I see currently in Iran on the ground is a regime that has never been more desperate, never been more weak, but still capable of lashing out, particularly against its own population.
Right.
I mean, the murder of execution, if you will, of the young wrestler and two other young men last week.
Right.
That is a warning to the rest of the Iranian population. If you protest, if you demonstrate, if you come out in any form and work against the regime, you will be killed. And I understand from NCRI sources and from other sources that there are thousands of Iranians that are being arrested. You know they're being tortured, and many are going to be executed because that is, as I said, in the DNA of the regime.
Right.
Yeah. So what you're seeing on the ground with regard to the resistance units, let's say, of the MEK, which is the major component of the NCRI, is pockets of resistance. And what we need to do is see the people of Iran turn out in force as they did previously. But, you know, if you got bombers overhead and the bombs are falling, that's probably going to be somewhat of a deterrent.
Right.
The brutality of the regime, because remember, the regime has the guns.
Right.
You know, and we're talking really about the IRGC in particular and the Basij. But, you know, it, at the end of the day, it's up to the Iranian people. On the political front, you have the NCRI putting forth announcing a provisional government. A provisional government that will serve as a transition to a free and democratic state. A secular state. A non-nuclear state. The principles are all laid out in the 10-point plan that you may be familiar with.
I was actually part of the with Ms. Rajavi. I was on the conference call where they were laying that out. I think that was last week, if I remember correctly. Yes.
Terrific. Well, I think that's very powerful. I mean, you have others competing. You have the son of the Shah, for example, who is claiming that he has a great deal of support within Iran. There's no evidence to suggest that's right, but he's very good at self-promoting. And, you know, in Washington, that matters.
Well, yeah, self-promotion is pretty, you know, I joke around about this podcast being all about shameless self-promotion, too. So, I mean, maybe I shouldn't entirely dismiss this. But yes, I mean, you know, there's a symbolism there, too, that probably has at least a little weight. So the NCRI, you know, I tend to think that the target of the previous popular revolt probably isn't the greatest way to bring in the next popular revolt, but which is what happened in early 1979. There's a reason why there's a revolt.
Yeah, it's a wonder to me that you would reestablish the corrupt and brutal monarchy that the 79 revolution overthrew. Remember, this was about overthrowing the Shah. The father of the son of the Shah, who is today proclaiming that he is the natural leader, but at the end of the day, President Trump has taken the measure of the man. He says he may be a nice man, but we need somebody that has the support within Iran.
Well, let's talk about that. And let's talk about the NCRI and the MEK, because I mean, most of us are probably not going to be very, very familiar with this. I'm a little familiar with it, but I'm certainly not an expert in these sorts of things. Apart from the Pahlavis, there are other factions, I guess you can say, that are competing for that. We can talk a little bit about that. And maybe talk a little bit about the opportunities for at least some of these different groups to work together to help create an alternative or move people on the ground. But the NCRI with the MEK on the ground already certainly has a fairly substantial spot in that field.
Yes, and I would think that once the regime implodes, and I think that's the right word, I think that's the best description, it will implode. If we stay the course, okay, which I'm optimistic like you that the president is going to do the right thing. But I think the NCRI MEK is clearly at the table, maybe at the head of the table, but there are others as well. And there's a, there is the Council of Resistance, and that is a broad sort of coalition of resistance groups. Most importantly, I think in terms of what we're seeing in Iran, the NCRI does have representation with the Azeris and the other sort of ethnic nationalities. And, you know, Iran is 90 million people, but it's a mosaic.
It is. It's diverse.
You know, of ethnicities. And that's important. And it's important to be able to work with those. You know, the son of the Shah has declared them to be separatists and has asked the IRGC, if you can imagine, the IRGC to put them down. That's not how you get to the end goal that I think we want. And that end goal is a government that is going to support our national security interests. I mean, you mentioned my background. The reason that I became associated with NCRI and the whole issue of Iran in terms of, you know, the regime and the need for regime change is because I concluded a long time ago, way back in 2003, 2004, that, you know, as long as this regime exists, we're going to be challenged by it on the nuclear front.
Right.
And the only way we can solve the nuclear problem is by ending the regime. And the only way to end the regime is through the Iranian people and the promotion of human rights, the promotion of freedom, the promotion of democracy. This is how we win the battle.
Let me ask you this, because I was on that conference call. It's a very interesting conference call. I've been on a few of these conference calls with the NCRI, and I've always found it to be an educational experience. One of the things that I was a little curious about, though, was their statement that we really don't want arms, we really don't want boots on the ground, we just want the West to stop appeasing the regime. And I certainly think that there's a huge amount of truth in that over the last 20 years or so. But I think appeasement has kind of ended. And I think it did sometime after the October 7th massacre. And I think we, especially when Trump came back into office, we started taking this incredibly seriously, maybe a lot more seriously than Trump did in his first term. I think he was working up to it, but I don't think he got there. How does the NCRI see the ability to collapse a regime and to replace it with a secular republic in the way that the NCRI is framing this, without getting some sort of arms assistance, without getting some sort of other types of, you know, military/economic assistance? Well, I mean, I don't think they're excluding economic assistance, but I was curious as to that construct. It sounded to me like they were pretty sure this thing was just about to topple over at that point in time. And I was curious as to why.
Well, we have a 30-year history. I mentioned the negotiations.
Yep.
In which the West, led by the United States in most cases, believed that we could negotiate with this regime, believed that we could have an agreement that would end their quest for nuclear weapons. And the method was appeasement. Instead of dropping bombs, we were sending cash over, you know, but not the millions, but the billions.
Yep.
Okay. And what the regime would do is they would take these concessions, these resources that were provided through the policy of appeasement, and build their missiles and build their nuclear program and repress their own people. It had exactly sort of the opposite effect that we wanted to achieve. Now, President Trump sought a negotiated outcome before Epic Fury began. And, you know, he took a different position than the previous administrations. He didn't pursue appeasement. He said, we need an effective agreement. And the response was, no, we're going to continue enrichment. We're going to continue to hang on to our 60% enriched uranium. We're going to continue to move in the fashion that we have, which also included, by the way, and very few people talk about this, total stonewalling of the IAEA on the weaponization front.
That's exactly right.
And so this was the end of appeasement for now. But I am of the school that there's no learning in Washington. And this corollary of that is there's never an end to bad ideas. And I would anticipate that if we don't finish the job now, and we leave even the remnants of the regime in place, even the remnants, we're going to have a future administration that's going to go right back to, yeah, well, you know, they're telling us they're not going to have a nuclear weapon. Okay, so for the 237th time, they told us that, but they've lied the first 236 times. So why would we, in God's name, believe it? But that's the nature of, well, that's the experience that I've observed over.
Well, and so the NCRI is basically saying, stay the course, is what they're saying with that. Don't let up. Don't go back to appeasement. I almost want to give you a your own law, Joseph's law. There is no end to bad ideas in Washington, D.C. we might make that a thing after this interview. I know I've got to let you go. You've got another call coming up here in just a minute or two. But Robert Joseph, thank you so much for talking with us today. And I look forward to talking to you maybe in a free Iran at some point in time.
That would be terrific. Thank you for having me. And very best to you.
Best to you as well, sir.